welcome to On the Record with Furniture Today, a podcast that goes behind the headlines to look at the news and the newsmakers, the people and the personalities that give the furniture industry its unique flavor. I'm your host, Bill McLaughlin, Editor-in-Chief of Furniture Today.
Hey, I'm Trisha Yearwood, here in Hollywood at the legendary Capitol Studios. If you're in High Point for the furniture market, be sure to stop by Klausner Home Furnishings, your one-stop shopping destination for everything furniture, including Nashville, the latest addition to my Trisha Yearwood home collection. You'll find something for every room, all of it inspired by my love of home, family, and friends, and what I call a recipe for comfortable living.
Come see the entire collection at Klausner, 101 North Hamilton.
Welcome to this week's edition of On the Record. My guest this week is Kevin O'Connor, a member of the Home Furnishings Hall of Fame and an inductee to the Hall of Fame, the former CEO and chairman of Samson Holdings. And now, as you just said yourself, you are semi-retired with a part-time, full-time job with City of Hope. So I'd like to talk to you a little bit. Before we went on air, we were talking a little bit about your history in the business, and you have been both a witness to history and an active participant in the history of the furniture industry over the last 50 years.
Yeah, this year.
Congratulations. People in the industry today talk a lot about disruption, and they look at Amazon as a disruptor, but you yourself were part of disruption. You created disruption in what you did with Legacy. Did you know you were being a disruptor when you did it?
Yeah, I think we did know that we were being a disruptor. I don't think we had any idea how impactful that decision to start the company and the model that we created was going to be. Things were changing. It's the middle 90s. China is starting to make bedroom furniture from probably 95, 96 on. It starts to show up, but it was, people were very skeptical of the quality of the, you know, of the workmanship and whether it would really work at that particular time. So 99 came along, and through a whole series of circumstances, myself and two other guys, Jerry Sagerdahl and Richard Mihalik, start a company called Legacy Classic. And the worst business day in my career turned out the next day to be the best business day of my career. That was primarily, we had been at Master Design, we had worked hard, we had in 4 or 5 years we had almost tripled the size of that company, and some things happened overseas that had us leave the company at that particular point that were, you know, not something that we wanted to be associated with. And I happened to be with Samuel and Grace Kuo during that time when we learned of the improprieties overseas with Master Design, Master Home. I knew nothing of it and felt compelled to come home and resign. And so we came back to the U.S. I had this thought. I was by myself at that time in China, very upset and, not really knowing what I wanted to do. But there was this thought going on at that time that the furniture industry, import furniture business, was going to change. Before that, everything came, basically made tables and chairs, occasional tables, dining tables, chairs, and they were flat pack buffets in China. You brought it to the United States, and then they were assembled in warehouses and then redistributed. So there was this really non-value added element that got introduced to the product, and then there was the storage of the product in the United States, which was obviously high, and then the redistribution. And people had talked about the fact that, you know, now that bedrooms had been made and you could fill up a container more easily, that was going to change the way things were done. And Samuel and I got into some immediate discussions the day after the blow up of Master Design, and we decided he offered to help me with it, and that was the great magic. We came home, we put a plan together, we sat down, and on, I think it was February 28th of 1999, we put together a business plan, and we shook an agreement, and he was going to be the financial backer for the company. And at that time, we started, I went out, and I asked Richard and Mihalik, who was our operations guy at Master Design, Jerry Sagadol, to join us. I trusted and knew those guys. I knew what they could do. And I had been going into Asia for 10 years at that point, so I kind of knew the landscape over there. But it was still pretty innovative. Now, at that time, there were about 40 or 50 companies that could buy a container. I mean, there were the Levitz's and the Montgomery Wards and the Sears and so on and so forth. But you had to buy 100 of everything, of anything, and it had to be cash on the barrel head and sort of out the door. Samuel and I agreed that if we could put together a warehouse, produce a product line, and essentially create a product line and a warehouse that looked like it was sitting in Hickory, North Carolina, and put it in mainland China, and then allow people to order three or four of these bedrooms and have multiple bedrooms and multiple dining rooms, multiple occasional table groups, it would be much easier to do business, we would increase that number of retailers that were able to take care of that. And honestly, Bill, I don't know that I'm sure Aunt Samuel asked me the question, so how many customers do you think you could have? And I think at that time I might have said, probably 125, 150. As reluctant as they were to embrace the idea, I guess, in a lot of ways, until they saw it working and they realized that this was something that was going to come. And I wasn't the only one to do it. I mean, there were companies like River's Edge that was starting to do the same thing. Excuse me. So it was becoming, we weren't the only game in town, but we were the best financially backed. And Samuel's factory was well known in China at the time that we started there, and was doing business with a lot of different people. It was a big change. It changed. It ultimately forced the changeover, it also led to the anti-dumping thing, which became the poster boy of Legacy became the poster boy of that. Samuel and Grace and Mohammed Amini, who ran our Far East side, as the president of Lacquercraft, we all fought that, and that was a successful endeavor as well, because it was we were the only ones, ourselves and Marco Furniture, who was also a supplier of mine at that time. We were the only ones found to be not to have any dumping duties. So that was a big plus, and it continued to underscore our legitimacy, if you want to say it that way. You were a disruptor. I'll be eternally grateful to people like Keith Koenig and Irv Blumpkin and so many others that I can't name, who basically said to me, Kevin, if this is what you want to do, we're going to give you an opportunity, because it was revolutionary at that time. The product sold immediately, and sold extremely well. It just jumped. I mean, our first, we actually showed at the market in High Point, couldn't show it. Furniture Market Night, but we showed out at Grandover. We rented a suite, and we had two bedrooms and two dining rooms. The folks at Macy's actually bought the bedroom and the dining room and put it in the centerfold. This was when Macy's was still regionally run. And Sandy Morrell at Macy's basically put us in the centerfold. They had a long history. I had a long history with Macy's, and they trusted me, and it became like the best-selling bedroom dining room that they had ever had. And we ran around with that circular to every place in America, you know, trying to show people that, you know, how legitimate we were. And that happened in the first 6 months. So it was, we got, a lot of things fell in place. You know, we thank the Lord for that one.
Being a disruptor is one thing. You kind of come in under the radar, you get to enjoy a period where people kind of don't know what you're doing. But at some point, your unique point of differentiation started to become something that other people were doing. Mm-hmm. And you go from being a disruptor to one of the leaders, one of the, as you say, a company mm-hmm. that everybody's kind of targeting. How do you manage the transition? How, as a, I mean, because at that point you were a leader of the company, mm-hmm. you were president of the company. How do you change the culture? How do you change the way you talk to your employees, the way that they view what they do? How do you manage that transition from disruptor to, I don't know what the term is for an anti-disruptor, right?
Well, I think there's two things. I think within the company, probably the thing that I'm the proudest of in creating legacy is that Jerry and Richard and myself, and we all played parts in this, significant parts in it. You know, I did the product development. Richard really ran the operations side. And Jerry was the sales, you know, sales and key account guy. But with every milestone that we reached, and I mean little ones, the first time we shipped, you know, let's just say probably $250,000 in a month, we would celebrate. And by celebrate, we had no money. We didn't, you know, it was a startup company. And I mean, in the very beginning, we would gather everybody at lunch on the Friday after the month closed. People in the warehouse, people in the office, and we would bring in pizzas. And we would sit there and we would celebrate the fact. And we were like the little engine that could, you know. And it was this little company with a band of, you know, it started with like 10 or 12 people. You know, and then as the business grew and we put people on, it was, we celebrated every moment. What I'm proudest of is that you create a culture where people feel they're a part of something. And they saw the success and they were proud of that success. And we shared that with them and made them feel like they were a major part of that. I remember the first time, one of the guys picked up the phone and called me, and we had done something wrong, and you know, meaning, you know, product wasn't right, or we had missed a ship date, or something like that. And it, you know, because we were so successful in the beginning that we were oversold constantly, you know, for years, and that was difficult to manage that success, but somebody said to me, you know, and they weren't happy, but at this difficult conversation I had with a major guy who remained nameless, he said to me, he said, you know, but at the end of the day, he said, you know, when I pick up the phone and I call whatever, she really cares. I get the feeling that she really cares about me, my problem, and she's doing her darndest to make it right, you know, to fix it. And he said, you know, that doesn't happen when I call other companies. And so creating a culture where everybody feels a part of something and you're a team operating together, that's what I'm most proud of. And I think that made it easy to manage through the difficult success, which was you were selling more than you could get, you know, in a lot of cases. And managing that, that was difficult, but we navigated through that, you know, pretty well.
How do you scale that? Right, it's one thing when you have 12 or 15 employees and you can call everybody around and you have pizza and communication is very direct, mm-hmm. right? You over the course of your career, managed a company of progressively larger and larger and larger size. And when you look at Samson Holdings now, it's multiple companies with multiple presidents in multiple headquarters, and yet you still have to be able to manage that.
Right.
I think a lot of executives struggle with that. How do you scale that?
I think there's two things. I think, first of all, you provide the focus, the overall focus of what you're trying to accomplish. And in multiple companies, then that's engineered down to the level of whoever the president of that division is, and so on and so forth. But the key to all of that, in my mind, is that it's not one guy at all. Now, you have to provide, you know, a vision, okay? But after the vision is provided, then it becomes the implementation of that. And I think that's when having key second, you know, middle management in the organization becomes critical. If you don't hire people who are, I want to say, of the same ilk that you are of what you made you successful, from an ethical, from you know, just coming from a moral and ethical background, I think is critical. I don't, you know, it's no mistake that people who have a strong moral company with a strong backbone of what they do, of integrity, those people succeed, because ultimately that shows through. It shows through in your employees. And then it gets filtered down. If you provide that leadership, people want to be led. They want to know how to do it the right way. And if they see you being successful doing that, then that kind of trickles down through the organization. And so, yeah, as we became 200 people at Legacy, it was the guy in the warehouse understanding, you know, how you treated people. Because treating people, if you simplify it down to the nth degree, treating people fairly is what makes, it's where the rubber hits the road. And that's what makes or destroys your company, is that, you know, personal integrity that everybody has down through the roots. And when you see somebody who doesn't do that, then that becomes a cancer, and you have to get that down. And it becomes, you know, I would think that becomes pretty obvious. It becomes more difficult as you get bigger, because it's, you're further away from it. And so you have to depend upon, you know, the chain of command to make sure that you have the right people in place. And that's not always easy. But finding I always felt like in the long run, Bill, I felt like my job, especially when I got to Samson Marketing, was finding the right guy for the top position, and then making sure that you and he were on the same page and then it would just flow downhill. I mean, Jeff Sheffer is a perfect example of that. You know, finding the right guy to put in Universal, and then changing the culture, because we needed to change the culture of Universal. It's much easier to start a company like Legacy and say, okay, here we are. This is our brand. This is what we stand for. This is what we're going to do. Everybody's new, and it's like, okay, that's their first marching orders. Okay, so that's fine. It's much different to buy a company like we did in 2001 at Universal, and then implement this model change. Doing the physical part of it was the easy part. Getting the rep force and getting the internal operations side of it, really believing that this is going to work, and that they were a very successful company at one time, but then we became the disruptor that had their business going in the wrong direction. So on one hand, they understood it, but getting the employees to basically embrace it and really believe that that's the way, you know, it was going to be done. Or they were more commercial. The big change that Jeff implemented for us was Universal was a direct competitor of Legacy when we bought them, and basically what we asked them to do is become move upstream, and that took Jeff. I mean, we did some of the things immediately that were very successful. The Paula Deen launch was a very successful launch and got us off on the right foot there. at higher price points and, you know, better product and whatever. But it took a number of years for it to be entrenched into the into where the company is today, so that they're a really different kind of company than they were, and very different from legacy, and very successful. And so, yeah, so changing, you know, finding the right people at the top, and then having them implement it, and having them create their own culture in that company becomes, you know, becomes very critical.
Very often when companies try to change culture, it seems like one of the things that they do is just try to turn the old culture over, right? If we just move all of these people out and we bring in new people will buy into the culture. It seems like, A, you don't believe that, and B, you've found another way. What do you think that Jeff has done, or what do you think is important in getting people to buy into that new culture? From a tactical standpoint, are there some specific things that you can recall?
I think the hardest thing that you have to go through is that the people who've been, and we had people who were there for a very, very long time. And Universal was arguably as successful as anybody in the furniture business at the time. You know, back in the middle 80s, they were the first ones to do this 18th century from the Far East furniture. They did Knightsbridge. So you had all these people who knew that, and then Alexander Julian, and there were successful collections and so on. They were more commercially priced. And the most difficulty that you have is that you've had a successful company and they want to say, well, let's do it like we used to. Maybe the new management that had happened along the way didn't do it that way. They tried certain ways and it didn't necessarily work. I can't say that, you know, we've had to make a lot of changes along the way. Jeff did some things in the very beginning, and he'll probably, when he sees this, he'll get mad at me for not remembering them, because he made everybody memorize the five things that Universal stood for every single day of the week. And, that they valued their customer, that they, you know, they were creative product, and, you know, they had these five elements, and that was ingrained, and they had to, you know, they had to recite it back. You know, it was almost like, and some people felt that was sort of elementary or condescending to do that, but it ingrained into them what we would do. We were serious about it. It was not just, oh, we'll try this for 6 months. Now, this is the way the company is going to be built. And frankly, some people believe it, embrace it, and get with the program, and others don't. And then you have to make choices. And it's very painful to let people who have been with your company 20, 30, 40 years, you know, I don't know if there were 40 years, but there were a lot of them that were there for a very long time, very successful, and, you know, just didn't understand where we were going. That was not them, so.
So you... We've talked kind of about your influence on organizations. Let's talk a little bit about who influenced you. You have worked with a few legendary figures in the course of your career, Nat Ansel, Pat Norton. Who were the people that influenced you? What did you learn as you were coming up in your career that you've tried to implement?
I mean, clearly, you know, if I go back and look at things, I was really, really blessed to work really directly, even as a young guy. I was 23 when I was the beginning of the kiddie corps. Ethan Allen was the first guy hired out of college to go and be on a road. And that was a kind of an experiment. They were just opening their showcase stores. So I got to work with a Pat Norton directly. Ultimately, you know, for a while I reported directly to Nat Ansel. Legendary Hall of Fame characters, they clearly probably influenced my life more than anybody else. But then, you know, later on when I left, I worked for a guy named Leonard Singer Leonard Fisher at Singer Furniture. At LAD, I worked with John Foster, but Don Hunziker and Bill Fenn, again, two Hall of Famers, were very influential in how I looked and ran a business, and you know, the financial, probably learned more about the financial impact from them and understanding it when working at LAD. Those were all kind of legendary people. You know, I learned from Aaron Hahn at Master Design. And certainly Samuel and Grace have been an influence. But if I go back, like anything in life, Bill, I think the younger you are, the more malleable you are, the more impressionable you are. When I started at Ethan Allen, we were in this, we had like 40, I think we were doing $45 million at the time. This is 1969, so 50 years ago.
It was worth a lot more back then, though.
Yeah, it was. It was, you know, I don't know what it would translate into today's dollars, but I think we had something like 20 showcase stores in the United States at the time. I'm not quite sure of that number, but it was few. And we were just starting to build out these Ethan Allen stores. It was a very exciting time. We were doing something. We were a disruptor. But I learned the integrity of having integrity with your customers and the way you treated people. I saw that in Pat. I saw that in Nat. I saw the visionary giant that Nat was, how he foresaw the future of the way the furniture industry would be. I mean, he was truly revolutionary, and probably the most revolutionary of all the people that I've worked for or been associated with. Pat was able to take that vision, okay, and really implement it. And his ability to work with people was his greatest asset. Pat could say the most god-awful things to people, at retailers, who he didn't think were doing justice to Ethan Allen at the time. And yet, and have awful these meetings where he would say these terrible things to people. And yet they walked out arm in arm with this guy because they realized that he had their best interest in mind as well as his company's. But he was trying to help them. And he was a tough guy in doing that. And so what I learned from that, you can be as tough as you want as long as you're fair. And I think that's a motto that I kind of tried to handle, you know, try to make a part of my agenda for all of those years. Well, probably more than anything else. And I think if you went to Kirk Darrow, where Pat later became infamous in the business, he would tell you the same thing. We were sort of the two adopted sons of Mr. Norton, and it was a gift. Yeah. So. Yeah, those are the people. Don Hunziker had to run a multi-layered company, and the ability to, you know, impact and really understand. I had gotten an MBA at Columbia when I was at Ethan Allen, but really implementing that, I was in a position where at LAD, you really were responsible for your own P&L statements and so on, and that understanding all of the engineering elements on the commercial side of the business. At Ethan Allen, we had our own world that we were dealing with. And I always say it was like being in the furniture business on Mars because it was you were separated. You were selling to your own customers, you know, who were just buying product from you and nobody else. When you got to Singer, working with the engineers, working with the people, and knowing how, you know, instead of making the leg out of a 3.5-inch block, which, you know, when you put it on the spindle carver and turned it, you know, it took it down to a size, and what was the cost of that 3.25-inch block versus the 3-inch block, and were you willing to make and compromise the design to hit a price point. It was the engineering of a product. It's something that I think kind of gets lost in today's import business because it's all over there. Somebody else is doing it and you're going over, and however you want to say it, it's almost like an OEM business again. You know, you send your designs over, and everybody does this to some degree, but it was more interactive when you were speaking English to an engineer, and they would come back with suggestions of how to save money on that. That gets done in China. It just doesn't. I don't think it gets done as easily as it did back then. With the guys in Hickory or wherever you were manufacturing.
Do you think that's why so many financial companies we've seen over the course of the furniture industry over the last 50 years, and I don't know if I'm sure you've probably heard of the book Furniture Wars. And,
oh, yeah.
Okay. So there's this long history of financial companies coming in to this business and thinking that sleepy business, really don't know what they're doing. We can come in and apply modern financial and business principles and yet time after time, there's a whole laundry list of companies that have just failed miserably. Why do you think that is? Does it go back to understanding that engineering principle, that connection between the factory floor and the selling floor?
I think that is part of it, but I think more than anything else, I think what I've observed is that there's an arrogance to the, and this is, I think this is true at retail, with the folks that came in on the retail side as well as the manufacturing side. They don't understand the way this crazy little business works in the sense that it, in a lot of ways still today, Bill, this is a cottage business in the sense that people do business with people. And I think there's an arrogance to some of the folks who have come into the business that say, well, you don't know what you're really doing here. If you do this and you do that, you do the other, we're going to blow this thing wide open and we're going to explode this business and so on and so forth. And it just doesn't work that way. The independent retailers that are out there today base a lot of their decisions on trust and trusting the people that are in place. And it's still on the on the manufacturing side, okay, supply side, it's still a product business. When it's, there was the guy, Hank Timnick, who used to run Stanley, had an expression, there are really three things important in the furniture business. The first one is product, the second one's product, and the third one is product. And, that's true, but I think at Legacy we proved that that's not the only thing that's true. Now, what was true was that, if you had the right vehicle and you had the right product, then it became very successful. And that's difficult in a world to differentiate today, especially when there are no labor differentials in the various places that are out there today. So, how do you make your company different? Some of these folks have come in and tried to make it different and then walked away from the general principles of what made the company successful. And some of that's old fashioned and it's breakthrough. I suspect that part of it is the same thing that we talked about earlier. It's like, okay, you could come in. Would it be successful if you had people that really embraced the idea from the old company when the new company comes in, that they really embrace that, or do they fight it? I suspect that part of the problem with the new company coming in is that I used the word arrogant before. I think there's a bit of arrogance there, and that kind of puts the people in place who've been running the business before kind of ill at ease. And do they try as hard to make it work as they should? Ultimately, you've got to kind of embrace it, because if they're in charge of the thing, it's going to fail one way or the other if you don't embrace it. So it's or you'll be gone. And I think they don't think they recognize the fact of the impact of the personal relationships that come between vendor and supplier, or the dynamics in the marketplace that that trip the trigger on why a consumer buys something, and they think they can apply, you know, what worked in the apparel business is going to work over here. The biggest problem you have today at retail, in my opinion, is that the stores, you know, that have survived the Great Recession, have they become, do they look like what today's customer wants? Do they look as good as their ads? Do they look as good as the internet guy who, now raise a lot of people's ire when saying this, but one of the reasons that internet is so successful today is that the consumer can go on and see all kinds of choices, but they see them in, you know, bright and pretty environments, all kinds of different environments. They can flip pages until they say, poof, that looks like me.
Right.
You know, that's what I want my house to look like. Retail brick and mortar stores have a difficult time being aspirational because it costs a lot of money to be aspirational and to be current and to keep it up. That's a challenge for a lot of stores. That's why I think people who focus just on the product itself, I give enormous amount of credit to companies like Rooms to Go and Ashley for making their stores. They've got the capital to reinvest in the stores and to make them look relevant and keep them fresh and keep them on trend and so on and so forth. The independent retailer has a harder time doing that, because the velocity, the volume, the capital that it cost people to stay in business from 2007-08 to whenever the Great Recession supposedly ended is difficult, and it's a changing world out there. So, that's difficult.
Hey, I'm Tricia Yearwood here in Hollywood at the legendary Capitol Studios. If you're in High Point for the furniture market, be sure to stop by Klausner Home Furnishings, your one-stop shopping destination for everything furniture, including Nashville, the latest addition to my Tricia Yearwood home collection. You'll find something for every room, all of it inspired by my love of home, family, and friends, and what I call a recipe for comfortable living.
Come see the entire collection at Klausner, 101 North Hamilton.
You talk about a store. You're a veteran furniture shopper. Just out of curiosity, when you walk into a furniture store, how do you look at the store? What catches your eye? What do you look at? Is it sight lines? Is it traffic flow? Is it vignettes? When you walk into a store and you're evaluating, if that's somebody that you've been selling. You talked about Pat Norton having tough conversations with retailers in their best interest. Mm-hmm. My guess is you've probably had to have a couple of those over time. So when you walk into a store, how do you look at it? How do you evaluate it?
Well, I think there's you have to understand what kind of store you're walking through. I mean, if you're walking through Nebraska Furniture Mart, it's a very different situation than you're walking through an independent retailer store. But to me, I'm not necessarily looking at sight lines as much as I am. Does the store create a level of excitement and energy? Is it bright? Is it colorful? Have you created displays that are aspirational? A lot of stores that you walk into, the first part of the store is nicely done, okay? And then you get into the bedroom area and it's like product sort of lined up in semi-vignettes and it's not accessorized as well. And, you're showing bedding, so you pull the bedspreads back, and maybe there isn't a lamp on every nightstand, and there's no accessories around, and so on and so forth, or rugs, and it's just product. So you're looking at pure product. I think one of the reasons that the upholstered part of the business does better than the case goods part of the business, and clearly that's shown. The statistics show you that upholstery has grown beyond 2008.
Okay, Epson's proved that over and over. Betting has proved that. You know, they've marketed themselves into a tremendous position with, you know, you're going to get sick if you don't replace a mattress in 7 years. With case goods, it's getting devalued because of the Vietnam element of this and gravitating down. It's never really gotten back up out of that position, you know, to a large degree. So when you get into those areas, upholstery, you know, there's some new bright things, and there's pillows, and there's rugs on the floor, and there's lamps on the table, and you know, and you can walk through there, and it's more aspirational. You get to the bedroom department, in many cases, it's just a bunch of product, and it's a bed, dresser, mirror, there's not a lot of what's going on, and it's jammed right next to something else. It may not be lined up like the old appliance store business, but it's like the next evolution. But it certainly hasn't taken the jump to what does a great looking bedroom look like? You know, with the advent of all the upholstered beds that are out there today, it's become more exciting looking. It's become softer. It's become more enticing. I think it's much more. I think if we could ever get our displays in retail stores to look as good as they do in the showrooms, which is not necessarily totally translatable, I understand that. But even halfway there, you know, I think the case goods business would be a lot better than it is today. And but that's the hard thing. So when I walk into a store, I'm looking for something to be aspirational. You know, and I get disappointed, I guess, when I see things more or less as commodities there. And I think that that's what the internet is able to move on. And I think the challenge, you know, retail, the brick and mortar store probably can't do all that I would like it to do. But the combination of kiosks and other opportunities to show product in the stores with and show how it could be displayed, or different ways that it could be displayed, I think is an opportunity that, you know, probably somewhere along the line be integrated into that experience. I certainly think it's an opportunity anyway.
My guest this week is Kevin O'Connor, Hall of Fame CEO and industry veteran. Let's look at the future of the furniture business. If you were going to project out the next 10 years, certainly not the next 50, we don't want to go back as far as you've been here, but if you were to project out the next 10 years, what do you think the furniture business will look like? Everybody guesses brick and mortar goes away. I think that's absurd.
I don't think it goes away.
No. But what does it look like? How does it evolve?
I think it's a much more integrated, program. I think e-tailers could be in the brick and mortar business. I think that some people in the brick and mortar business are going to immerse themselves more in the digital, you know, world, so that there's some things that are just undeniable. The younger consumer is not going to jump in a car, okay, and travel to 10 different furniture stores to figure out whether they can find something that they like. They're much more likely to go online. Now, you know, even people my age, okay, are buying. I happen to live at least half my time on Kiawah Island. There's a lot of money on Kiawah Island, and I go to cocktail parties and dinners and with people, and these are folks who are largely more my age than, you know, and they are looking online. Now, they may not know how to, some of them may not know how to purchase it online like that, okay, because that's still a foreign object, that thing you have in front of you, that computer. It's becoming clear that they shop online. They look online. That the magazines, the shelter magazines, are online now. I mean, that's where they look. I think that there are stores around today that are aspirational, that provide customers with a glimpse of some kind of product and different accessories and so on. Look, I think if you took all the industry executives in our industry and you asked them when they take, in the old days, it used to be Sundays, used to be the family day, okay? So you drag your wife and kids or husband and kids or whatever through the showroom to show them what the hell you'd been doing for the last 6 months. And, you know, it would always be frustrating, and I think this is true, you know, most of us have been around for a while, that, you know, you're looking at the product that you produced, and my wife would be looking at the pictures and the bedspreads and the rug on the floor and how nicely they accessorized the group and where did she get that? You know, it's like, I think that stores that provide the environment around the furniture itself becomes a much bigger part of this as time goes along if you're going to be successful in the furniture business. So, you know, Nat Ansel had an expression a long time ago when we started the showcase stores. And he said, you know, furniture is like the body. And he would use the expression, and maybe it's sexist today to say this, but, you know, he used the illustration of a woman and how she dresses herself, the makeup that she puts on, the jewelry that she wears, the way she makes her hair, et cetera, et cetera, the clothes that she wears, the jewelry that she puts on. That's the same as what happens, you know, in a homemaker, you know, putting together a house. So, yeah, the furniture is an important part of it. But so is all that other. So, equally, if not more important, is all the other stuff that goes around with it. So, accessories and rugs and pillows and, you know, lighting and so on. That's all part of the makeup. I think the fact that we still do a very small part of our business, you know, in furniture stores, with that part of the industry, is a mistake. And I think that stores like in down in South Carolina, GDC, you know, they're kind of, they have some furniture in there, but it's largely about all of the, I'll call it fluff,
right?
Offending the accessory and lighting people, but that's really important, and it's and creating that environment that goes around the furniture, and I think that becomes, I think those kinds of stores, you know, flourish and probably get bigger, and. You know, so it's almost starting from the accessory and end of the business, and then introducing case goods that, you know, and upholstery that's part of it. That may start to happen more because, and it may be forced that way because of the internet. So, you know, do I think that becomes more important as time goes along? Yeah, probably so. You know, because it's. There's people that are just going to buy commodities, but I think that's why wood furniture anyway has gotten devalued as much as it has, and that's why I think we need to. I think as a result of the recession, Bill, that everything has been kind of a commodity, and we've dumbed down designs to hit price points. I think that's about to change. I do. I think there is going to be a revolution, and there's going to be a start of more styling, and I think that's really important for our business to survive, because I think that I'm starting to see little elements of that. You know, at the better end, I'm starting to see that again, and new companies are replacing the Henrodons and the Drexels and so on and so forth, and those are the Universals, the Hookers, the Bernhardts, you know, and then there are these new companies that are coming along that are going to take over for that. And it's just a food fight at the bottom, and it all looks the same. How much gray furniture can we sell, you know, in the last couple of years? Not everybody wants that, and they're going to get tired of it. It's like everything else, the style changes. It's a fashion business, it still is. And I think we're going to revert back to more style, and hopefully, you know, a little bit better end of things. I think that's what our companies have always tried to do better. And I think for us to do anything other than that would be a mistake on our part. We don't want to be like everybody else.
As we were wrapping up, Kevin shared this anecdote about one of his experiences with Nat Ansel that he felt typified Mr. Ansel's leadership and his style of dealing with employees.
And we started an adoption process because we needed residency in Connecticut at that time. And at that time, the abortion laws had just been, people were having abortions. You know, Caucasian infants were difficult to come by. We were told after we applied and passed muster that it would probably be 2, 3, maybe even 4 years before a child would become available. Well, for some unknown reason, about, I don't know, 9 months or, I guess we had moved up there, and maybe 9 months or so after we completed the process, we get this call. Come down and we want you to tell you about this child that we think might be available to you. They tell you what the background is, whatever they know, which was not much in this particular case. And then they said, well, come down the next day. If you were okay with all of that, then you come down the next day. And you can see the baby. And evidently what happens is that people who say they want to adopt, sometimes it's like plate glass fever. You know, you get there and you hold the baby, and sometimes it's maybe the colorations of the baby don't match up with what your expectations were or whatever. But for whatever reasons, they have cases where, you know, people said, wait a minute, I'm not quite ready. Well, I don't know. I think Christine could have been pink, you know, could have been purple, green, and, you know, and she was the cutest thing we ever saw. And then, so, you know, we went home with a baby that day. And for the first year, you are a foster parent when you adopt. You are not, because the, whether it be Catholic Charities or whatever the adoption agency might be, they kind of monitor you and the baby to make sure everything's going along fine. And so 11 months goes by. And during those 11 months, the couple who couldn't have a baby got pregnant. Okay. Yeah. And we're almost, now this is how young you are and how whatever, innocent or stupid. You know, we were afraid that her showing was going to somehow influence them, that they would take the baby back. So we're doing everything to kind of deny that, not deny, but you. And they come to us in the 11th month and they say, well, we got a problem. This is like a shock. Now, we haven't thought about the fact you sign a piece of paper that say you're a foster parent, right, and a year from now you're going to fully, we'll sign the papers. Well, you take that baby home and the baby's yours. I mean, that's, you know, this is as much of, and anybody who tells you that an adopted child is different from your own child, it's crazy. If anything, it's even more your child, because that's how bad you wanted that baby in the first place. And you realize it's a gift. And so they come and they said, the state of Connecticut has now had a change of laws. You adopted, and they just passed this new law like January 1st, and this is like December they're coming to us, and they say it's held up in the Senate, or they never put, what they're now saying is both parents, both the mother and the father, if they know, have to sign off on the fact that you're going to have it, you know, you're going to put the baby up for adoption. Well, they got the mother's permission, but they didn't necessarily know the father, or could get in touch with them, or whatever the case may be. So they were going to put classified ads in the paper advertising for the father and do everything that they could. And there was a potential, if the father came back at that particular point and said, you know, I don't want it, then whatever. Now, in the process, we know we're in this quandary, and I immediately became, there were, I think, 400 babies in this condition. So I went to Nat and I said, look, we could lose this child. And I went directly to Nat. I think I was working for Nat at that particular point on one of his projects. And I said, listen, I may call you from Canada or someplace and say, I'm not showing up for work tomorrow morning because we're not losing this baby. Come hell or high water, we're going to do whatever it takes to. And there was a very important case at that time. It was in Florida. It's the DiMartino case where the natural parents came back against the adopted parents. And it was in legal. It was a highly publicized case in New York at that time. And so Nat gets on the phone. He said, look, I understand. Let me see if I can help you. So he calls up Ella Grasso, who was the governor of Connecticut at that time. And there was no such thing as, we had what they called a Selectric typewriter at that time, an IBM Selectric,
yes.
Okay, with the ball.
Uh-huh.
Well, there was a mag card, which was basically, you could create the body of the letter, and it would automatically type the letter for you. So we created, I don't know, 150 letters for all of the senators and all of the House of Representatives. I went and spoke before the state Congress, and represented the parents, which was pretty scary because I was like 26 or something like that at that time. So, but Nat brought in all of our representatives from the local area, including that he had just moved the company to Connecticut, so he was a big deal. And he calls in these people and he brings them into the boardroom and he lets me tell the story. He says, "Listen, brought you all in here," and this was Nat, you know. Brought you all in here now, listen to this. You know, because he was, at that point in his life, he had a very colorful language. And, I want you to listen to him. And we used the company facilities to write individual letters to each of these senators and representatives. And we got it passed. But that's the kind of thing that Nat would do for you if you were in his, in his circle. And for some reason, he took me under his wing immediately when I came back out of the field in 71 or whatever it was, and came back to New York. Norton had brought me back in to run the sales administration department, be his administrative assistant. And I mean, he would take me to dinners with I can't remember the name of the group now. But I would be sitting with the president of Whirlpool and the president of New York Bell, and he exposed me at an early age. I mean, they were all vice presidents, and here's Madeline and I sitting there. And the nice part is that they all treated us like we were equals, and I was far beneath them being equals at 26 or 25 or whatever I was when I first got back to New York. And those were the kinds of things that I'm forever grateful to him for the exposure, because all of that exposure just put you in a, you saw the world a different way.
Well, I think that's a great and hopeful place to wrap things up.
I certainly
thank you
hope
so much for taking the time.
Bill, it's my
pleasure. Really appreciate it.
All right.
Thank you for being in the chair.
Thank you.
My guest is Kevin O'Connor.